Good day, good people, and welcome to the Poolproof Wisdom Podcast, Conversations. Today, it's all about our animal friends and companions, furry and otherwise. We speak in this space about all manner of human topics and issues, but for many of us, our dogs, cats, reptiles, pigs, horses, llamas, and every other kind of animal friend under the sun are part of the family and often perceived by many of us as so much better than a whole lot of human beings. But that said, there are issues when it comes to the animals we care for and love. Issues about protecting animals that run the gamut, often horrifying those of us who have an appreciation of all living creatures. And there are many, many more. Now today, we're going to dive into this discussion and address all the good news about how great our animal companions are with today's guest, Catherine Chenard, Executive Vice President for the Association for Animal Welfare Advancement. Catherine has more than 26 years of experience in animal advocacy that she brings to her role with the Association for Animal Welfare Advancement. She speaks publicly on leadership, culture, coalition building, communications, fundraising, and industry trends. Her animal welfare career began as communications head for the Humane Society of Missouri. She has since served as executive director for the Animal Protective Association of Missouri, animal welfare issues consultant for the Humane Society of the United States, president and CEO of Asheville Humane Society, and executive vice president for San Diego's Humane Society. She is an author of Coalition Building for Animal Care Organizations as well. And I'm proud to say, Catherine is a former student of mine when I taught university classes in journalism and newspaper production, along with others, back in my hometown of St. Louis, Missouri. I couldn't be prouder of who she's become and how she is making a difference in the world. Good morning, Catherine, and welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're here. So where are you this morning? Where are you located again?
Well, good morning, Charles. I'm so happy to be here. And this morning, I'm coming to you from a dreary, dark, and ugly Tampa Bay, Florida.
Oh, my.
Normally, it's beautiful and gorgeous and sunny, but today it's overcast. But again, first world problems.
Yeah, definitely so. I suppose it could be worse, but you know, we only know what we know, so we're going to roll with it, right?
Yep.
Well, as I said, so glad that you can join us this morning. And this is a topic close to my heart. Obviously, I know it's close to yours. I mean, you've made an entire career out of it and so successfully. But I happen to have been a person who started life as a young person who had, you know, dogs or cats, you know, typical things. But when I grew to adulthood, I left it for a long time, only to in 2010, I believe, getting another dog and fell in love and ended up inheriting one later on from my sister. And I'm the biggest animal lover ever because one thing is true. I think that animals are better than a lot of people. I think that a lot of us could say that. But I wanted to talk to you this morning not only about what that means as we are looking at the world and what animals mean to us, but also in terms of some of the challenges from an advocacy standpoint. And you've built your career not only caring about animals personally, but caring about them in the broader sense of it in terms of making sure that there are rights and protections for them. Now, the first question is, a lot of people have issues with those of us who believe that animals deserve to be protected. And they think it's weird when we talk about animals as members of our family and all of the other types of ways we see them. Tell me what you say to those people about why this work is important.
Well, first of all, thank you for that question, because it is an opportunity to really address that our relationship with animals is culturally based. And for so many years, I've encountered people who are absolutely in love with animals, or they are scared of them, or they think they're dirty. I mean, and a lot of it has to do with how they're raised and from what culture. For example, you know, in the United States, we were not able to have dogs in our bedroom until like the 1950s, because people you didn't do that. And so as the dogs have moved from the backyard into the living room, into the bedroom, you know, Americans have really embraced our canine and feline friends with a lot of passion and love and that human-animal bond. Other communities that have different origins of culture, for example, in the Somalian culture, a lot of Somali immigrants come to the United States and their culture is horribly afraid of dogs. And so some organizations work with helping to build trust with those children because it's so foreign to them. So, and you look at other different types of communities, like maybe the Latinx community or anybody in the BIPOC community, depending on how you were raised and the relationship you had with animals as a child really sort of dictates your biases as you age. And so we as a culture have evolved into treating pets as part of the family, but everybody brings their own, you know, historical perspective of their relationship. But what I like to ask when people tell me that they don't like animals or they feel that they're not, you know, they don't feel comfortable with them, I like to find out what type of relationship they had with an animal as a child, because that sort of helps frame the conversation and helps me understand where they're coming from. And I think it's important that we meet people where they are and go from there. And the expectation that anyone has that somebody should love animals the way that you do speaks more about you than it does that person. And if you're going to be an advocate and you're going to really work to make this world better for animals, you have to meet people where they are and then go from there. So I don't mind it when people tell me they don't like animals. I find it an opportunity to find out why and learn a little bit more about them. And I think it's very helpful.
I think that's really a compelling point of view. And I can tell you, because, you know, no group is monolithic, but I have had people who look like me who are like, I can't believe that you treat your pets like children. And I did. I mean, they had more clothes than I did. Car seats, you know, I was obsessed with them. I mean, my life, you know, since I think you already know this, they both passed away. But, you know, the fact is that when they were here, they were the center of how I planned everything. When I was going away, were they going to be taken care of? Everything. If I had kids, they would have been very well cared for, but these were my children. And a lot of people who are Black folks always, I actually had a friend who told me once, and this is exactly what she said. She said, "You treat your dogs like white people treat their dogs."
That's fantastic. Okay.
I'm like, I don't know what that means, but why don't you explain? And she said that, you know, we all have dogs, but, you know, we don't go that far. I mean, a dog is a dog, a cat is a cat, so on and so forth. But, you know, you really treat them like they're personages that need to be given certain wiggle room within mm-hmm. your life as opposed to just a pet. And I said, because they're not that. They require all the care and compassion we can give them. So that perspective certainly doesn't apply to every person who looks like me, or for that matter, every person who looks like you when it comes to that. But just given that there's the capacity for what you said, what you consider important in terms of how you live your life, what you value, and how you treat living things, all living things, that I think infuses how you approach your relationship with animals. And therefore, advocacy becomes important. I think we've all probably had that moment when we wake up, and I get up early anyway. I think they've changed the music, but there's some organization that had the Sarah McLachlan song playing, "I Will Remember You," and the poor pictures of the animals, you know, abused, and it just breaks your heart. And I'm always thinking that if you can see anything that's a living being abused and think that you don't care about it because it's not a human being, I think something's wrong with you. What do you say to that?
I think it goes back to how your core values and expectations were as a child. I think if you were not raised in an environment of compassion and empathy towards other living beings, of course, you're not going to demonstrate that as you become an adult. And so what I love to see is when you work with children and they have not been exposed to animals, or you work with children who've actually been victims of abuse and they are forging a bond with an animal for the first time. And it's magical. It's amazing to watch just the transformation of how that child interacts. And, you know, maybe when they first met that dog, they were very afraid, but then as they become more comfortable, they really start to learn that unconditional love and affection that pets give us is a gift that you don't really find anywhere else in this world. And so I think, you know, hearing that somebody told you that you treat your pets like white people treat their pets, mm-hmm. that is so telling, because that speaks to the cultural divide and just where folks are in their journey. But I will tell you, I think we as Americans have surpassed that. You know, so often when I've been working with folks of different origins and cultures, let me tell you, they are pampering that little baby dog, and that baby dog gets everything before they do. A lot of the work that's being done in underserved communities through the Pets for Life program that the Humane Society of the United States does, and a very good friend of mine who I love, Amanda Arrington, you know, she's actually made her program almost ubiquitous across the United States. She's in 50 different markets. And for so many years, there's been this belief that, you know, people of color or people who are not the traditional, you know, WASP described person, they don't care about their pets. And that's the furthest from the truth. And so when you start going into communities where you see BIPOC individuals, those pets are the loves of their life. Mm. And for many of them, that's all they have. Mm. For many of them, it's that cat or that dog is their emotional connection and their reason for waking up in the morning sometimes. You see that a lot with the elderly. You see that with people who are homebound. So some of the intersection of where advocacy comes into play here is when you have individuals who are chronically ill, homebound, you know, living alone, and they have their pet as their only source of comfort. And then you start looking at some of the socioeconomic impact of policies around animals. So you have situations where landlords aren't, you know, open to having pets. And all of a sudden, having a pet becomes an obstacle that a person has instead of a joy that a person has. And so there's been a lot of work in recent years where looking at housing policies and governmental housing and really trying to establish a pet friendly policy versus a discriminatory policy. And it's, you find out really quickly how much people love their pets when they're faced with having to decide, do I get to keep my apartment? Do I get to keep my house? Or do I get to keep my dog?
Right.
And that's an intense experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, it's interesting. When I moved here, Diddy passed away in February, but I used to always pick him up and kid with him. And I was like, I'm going to have to get you a job because I now have to pay rent for you, because the building I live in, you know, charged the deposit, which of course a number of places do. But then there was a monthly rent for the dog. And, you know, it wasn't like the biggest deal. And I'm, you know, obviously realistic that I'm fortunate that I could pay it. But you know, you're spending like $50 a month just to have your dog in the apartment with you. That can be a real hardship, I know, for a lot of people. So, again, that advocacy point of view that you're referencing is important, because the need is definitely there. And I do think I want to pivot now a little bit to talk about, you know, that advocacy a little bit more. Now, the statistic I read, and this is just for dogs and cats, said that there are 2/3 of American households that are being shared with dogs or cats. And that's not including all the other new kind of animals that have become domesticated. I actually have a friend who has a llama. So,
of course you do.
Well, you know, what can I say? But I told my friend, I said, you know, God bless you, because my basic rule is, even with dogs, I always had smaller ones, because my rule is that I don't have a pet whose poop I can't pick up with one hand. If it's bigger than that, can't be in my house. So he has a llama, God bless him. But, you know, sharing our homes with animals, and a lot of people who are doing this too are doing it on behalf of their children because they want them to have that experience. And when we see that, it made me think about when we went into the quarantine in 2020. And there seemed to be a run on people deciding, well, I don't have anything else I'm going to do. I'm going to get this pet or I'm going to get that pet, and then sharing that space with them. But on an advocacy front, what I have been hearing and noticing is that as we're coming out of this now, people are like, well, life is getting back to, quote, normal. So now I'm not going to do this. So animals that were adopted and brought into homes are now being returned. How do you balance the scale in terms of what that means with people and this growing tendency toward wanting to have animals in their lives and this shift that has now said, okay, so you've loved me, you've cared for me, you've been a good companion during the quarantine, but now I'm ready to get back to life. What are the parameters of how we should respond to that particular approach to things?
Well, first of all, I'm really glad you brought this up because there's a huge misconception out there that that is what happened, that people adopted animals and then have quickly relinquished them or returned them as we as a country opened back up because of the pandemic. And so this speaks more to how the media perhaps doesn't always do their homework and look to data versus anecdotal experience. And so there were some articles that were written and circulated throughout different medias that spoke to this issue of, you know, people returning their pets, and that's simply not true. So we've actually spent some time through the organization I work for really trying to help explain it through the use of data. And so we work very closely with an organization called Shelter Animals Count, and also all the software companies who manage the database software for animal shelters across the United States and Canada, because I always like to use data and factual information to, you know, create the narrative. And so it's always disconcerting when you read something or you see something on the internet and you're like, who are they talking to? And I think you and I both know that sometimes the media can be a little lazy.
Just a tad.
And maybe chase the headline and not really dig deep enough. So the one thing I think is interesting is that Americans, as the generations have evolved in their relationship with pets, you know, millennials now own more pets than they are getting married or having children. And so I read something from the U.S. Bureau of Labor recently that said by the year 2026, there needs to be the recruitment, training, and retention of 64,000 groomers in the United States to meet the demand. And so if that doesn't say something right there about how the pet industry has become a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States, it just is. And it's the numbers 10 years ago were shocking, but now, again, people are having less children, people are having their pets sleep with them in their bedroom, in their beds. And it's just a wonderful new way of enjoying life. And that human-animal bond, it's so amazing. And people love their pets and their pets love them. And it's here to stay and it's only going to get stronger. So that speaks to another issue, which is, I think Banfield did a study last year, the year before, that indicated a significant crisis in the veterinary space where animals, again, are becoming the focal point of so many folks' lives. And the shortage of veterinarians says, basically, the study said something to the effect of in the next 10 years, there will be such a shortage of veterinarians that access to care for pet owners, and I'm not talking about underserved communities or poverty level pet owners, I'm talking about everyday middle American pet owners, they will not be able to have consistent vet care because the shortage is so bad. And so I think the number is something like in the next 10 years, there's going to be 73 million pets who will not have access to vet care in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what do you do? And so there's a lot of work being done because all these things are connected, you know, the rise and rise in importance that pets play in our families has made a whole cultural shift that has economic impact. And when the U.S. Labor Bureau is recognizing that there's a crisis in the grooming industry, that speaks volumes about the impact that pets have had on our way of life in America.
Yeah. Any insights behind why people aren't becoming veterinarians and this care model that you're referring to? What's behind it? Do you have any idea?
Well, I'm very invested in this issue because so many of my friends and colleagues, you know, not having veterinary medicine accessible is a real huge issue for animal shelters, sure. Right? So sure. We're looking at it more holistically. And so there's several different complications that sort of weave this tangled web. First and foremost, the economic model for becoming a veterinarian is flawed. For example, if you go to veterinary school, it is not uncommon for you to graduate with a debt load of $150,000 to $300,000. And so your first job that you get as a veterinarian, maybe you're making $100,000, but your debt to income ratio is so skewed that you cannot even afford a mortgage. So all of a sudden you've just started out in life and this debt is crippling you and your way of life. So right there's a problem. Then from there you go to a situation where, unlike other ways that we seek healthcare, you know, if you go to the doctor, you go to the human doctor and you have a conversation with your doctor about what sort of medical care you need and, you know, what kind of treatment plan you should pursue. I don't know anybody who then looks at their doctor and says, well, do we really have to spend that kind of money on getting these tests? I mean, do I really need to? Can't we do some, isn't there a less expensive approach? Hmm. Nobody haggles with their personal physician about their healthcare because we have health insurance. And so it's not a part of the conversation. But if you're a pet owner and you go in to meet with your veterinarian and the veterinarian prescribes a treatment plan, more often than not, people aren't willing to pay that. And so all of a sudden the veterinarian has to stop being a doctor and become a salesperson and justify and go through a financial negotiation, which is just, it's very disturbing. If you're doing that every single day, there's a real impact on your morale and your emotional state of being. And so unfortunately, veterinarians are tragically, they have like the number one suicide rate of professionals.
Yeah. You know, Catherine, I want to pick up on that a little bit more. When I had my dogs, they both, obviously, they had health insurance, dog pet insurance. And, you know, just like with human insurance, you know, there are a lot of things they didn't cover, but that's just, you know, part of the game. That dynamic where this is a living being in your home and you love them and you care for them, I just can't even fathom personally. If anything was wrong with, you know, my, you know, dogs, off to the vet we went, and I didn't care what it cost. It was more always for me about, is this something essential for them, or is it simply going to be something that makes them suffer through it and not necessarily correct the problem? The financial part is a burden. I totally get it, but you're exactly right. I would never, I went to my doctor and he said, I want you to have this test, say, can I get that for 20% off? Because it's right? The life that you're concerned with. So that shift occurring is going to be based up on a number of factors. But I think the first one has to begin with understanding that it's more than a cost. It is about an opportunity to keep your companion, your friend, your furry baby, whatever you call it, if it's a reptile, whatever you call that for that matter, well and healthy. And have we crossed that bridge yet collectively outside of loving them? Well, we understand that we have that responsibility for maintaining their wellness and health. Do you think? Have we crossed that bridge?
I think we're on the bridge. I don't know that we've crossed it. I think, again, you know, for so many years, having a pet was sort of a luxury, and you use discretionary income to pay for the privilege of having that pet. And so now I think when you look at younger generations, like millennials or Generation Z, they are buying pet insurance. They are making sure that they're prioritizing the health and care of their pet. Almost, and again, to the point, because they're treating them, you know, like children, you know, that's the generation that's paying for their dogs to go to a puppy play group, or you know, they want to feed the human grade pet food.
Right.
So, you know, they're doing so much more for their pets than, you know, my generation or the baby boomer generation. And so I think it's just the evolution, but I think in the next 10 years, I mean, the majority of pets are currently owned by millennials and Gen Z. So yeah, I think it's changing. I feel like I personally am in the middle, you know, being a Generation X, and I have some of my pets on pet insurance and some I do not. And the reasoning is because I have a French bulldog and I have a Rottweiler, both breeds of which are at the very top of the list of, we're going to have medical problems and we're going to cost you a lot of money. And so I didn't even hesitate. I was like, let's get them on insurance.
Right.
But our, you know, the cats that we have in our home, and we have an elderly Chihuahua, you know, we don't have them on health insurance. So, you know, I think as with any other trend, I think pet ownership is going to become more and more evolved. And I think insurance is going to be more the norm than not. And it's, you know, it's a peace of mind that a lot of pet owners want to have.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And, you know, when you're speaking about the younger generations and how they're treating it, it's interesting because I also read a statistic about fewer of them are choosing to have children. And I think that point about the dogs, the cats, the guinea pigs, the whatever it is taking the place is true in California, as you know, because you lived in San Diego. And certainly here in LA, it's a total dog culture. I mean, my best friend was here last weekend and he was remarking on the fact, he was like, my gosh, everywhere you go, there are people with dogs at the restaurants, at the malls, wherever you go. And I think that, yeah, we're going to see a lot more of that. And that literally makes me feel good. And that's a huge leap from where I was 20 years ago when I was like, I'm not going to have a dog. It's too much work. It's too much this. Because now you see all of these little and sometimes big furry friends being treated like members of the family in real time. And it's not just said. And I'm hoping that what you're suggesting here comes to fruition, because I think that they make your life better. Any type of animal, I think, that you make a connection to, I think makes your life better. And so I want to talk now a little bit about that particular aspect of things, you know, through the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic. Years ago, when I first got my dog, who was named Faith and was a Chihuahua, I wrote something when I was, you know, doing my blog called Things My Dog Taught Me, because that little dog taught me things that were so valuable that I still carry them with me today. And one of them was about the importance of being in awe of everything. I mean, you can relate to this. I would take the, you know, little one out every day and we'd walk pretty much the same path. But no matter what, every time she'd come across a new blade of grass and it was the most special thing in the world to her, or she'd come across a new scent that just made her, you know, sit back and have a good time. And I constantly watched this, and it gave me an appreciation for taking nothing for granted, but being appreciative of everything. During the pandemic, you know, as people got dogs, and thank you for correcting that misinformation about them getting rid of them now. I'm glad to hear that. But as people got dogs and maintained them, I think the dogs also taught us all a lot about how to live through that pandemic. And, you know, if I relate it kind of to the training that we, you know, give to dogs, if you take them to someone to train them or train them yourselves, I came up with three areas that I thought that I'd like to have you weigh in on in terms of what dogs taught us from the pandemic that we're now, we not only applied then, but we're applying now. And that is, when we train dogs, we teach them positive reinforcement. We teach them, you know, or we try not to flood them with too much information and engagement with others and new experiences too quickly. And we have to teach ourselves, as we teach them, to counter condition so that we are in a position to be gentle with ourselves as we expect them to be gentle with us. So tell me, from your perspective, animal lover that you are, animal advocate that you are, what are the things you have seen or experienced or heard of that have been about what animals have potentially taught us about dealing with the challenge of the quarantine and the pandemic, and what they are potentially still going to teach us to this day about how to live into what comes next? Because there isn't so much a new normal, I think, as much as there is a new reality we all have to live into. Any thoughts on that?
Well, sure. I think that the pandemic has taught all of us and given us an opportunity to examine our life. You know, where are we? You know, what's really important to us? It was, you know, in many ways, the pandemic was a wake-up call. And for those folks who didn't love their job, maybe they didn't return to that job, you know. So I think for people who, you know, lead very busy lives and all of a sudden being put into isolation, I think the reason people gravitated towards pet was because they were lonely and they wanted that connection. And pets do teach us how to have greater sympathy, empathy, compassion. When you start looking at the world through the eyes of your animals and your pets, it just changes the way you see the world. And so I think what animals teach us most is compassion. I think what they are able to do for us as individuals is give us a place of safety and security when it comes to feeling loved and valued. And again, I can't stress this enough with certain populations, like the homebound, elderly, you know, chronically ill individuals. Those are the ones who most rely on that relationship with their pet, because that's might be the only relationship that they have. And so that's why it's so frustrating to see that some of those marginalized communities are at risk of losing their pets because of, you know, bad housing policy or some sort of economic reason. So what I've really seen a significant shift in over the years has been, instead of animal shelters serving as repositories for people to bring their unwanted pets, you know, really the shift now in the past 10 years has been, how do we help people keep their pets and out of the shelter? Because when you look at the reason why animals are brought to animal shelters, it's there's been some sort of life experience for their owner, like a divorce, loss of a job, you know, and quite frankly, life is hard and things happen and people love their pets, but if they can't care for them, if they've been evicted, they don't have anywhere to go. So they come to the shelter. So rather than being judgmental and saying that this reflects poorly on that person, let's come from a place of compassion and empathy and say, you know, what brought you here today? What circumstance in your life brought you here today? And sometimes it's something as simple as the animal has a medical issue and they don't have the $1,200 to have that animal cared for at their local veterinarian. And so historically the model has been, well, you can't afford to get this medical care for your pet, so you're going to have to relinquish your pet to the shelter. The shelter is going to spend money to, you know, medicate or provide surgery or whatever needs to happen. And then we're going to find a new home for that animal. Well, that animal already belongs to somebody else and that animal is already loved. And the person brings this pet to the shelter because they can't afford to take care of them and they want to help them. And so we punish the human by taking the animal away from them and giving them to a new family. And so and I used to believe that was the right thing to do 20 years ago, but I have since grown to learn that really what needs to happen is we need to, again, meet people where they are, find out what they need, and help them to keep their pets, because that is what's most important. So when I say that, you know, when you ask me what have pets taught us, truly it's compassion. And the compassion extends to both ends of the leash. It's not just compassion for the dog, it's compassion for the human and the dog and the circumstances that they're in, and how do we help make their circumstances better? Because if we can do that, then if we focus on that approach, then we're lifting up our whole community. You know, we're making our community a more humane and compassionate community. And that's really what we all, you know, aspire to. And I think, you know, animals are, you know, sort of the perfect example of, you know, animals don't see race, they don't see socioeconomic differences, they don't care if you're ugly, if you're beautiful. What they care about is that you're paying attention to them and that it's a joyful experience. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that with any other relationship in your life.
Ain't that the truth?
Yes.
So, yeah, and I'm looking at some statistics. These are allegedly from, you know, 2020. This says that, and it primarily deals with cats and dogs because that's what most people are thinking of. But it says that there are 4.3 million cats and dogs in animal shelters in 2020. And the number also says is that 83% of those were saved, but roughly 347,000 cats and dogs were killed because they were in that kind of shelter. Now, Los Angeles became a no-kill shelter city. I think this was either earlier this year or last year. I don't remember when. So when we're talking about that shelter experience, there are still states which do this. Now, of course, there are circumstances that warrant because of the pet's health, and there's always that level of compassion you speak to. But talk to me about, you know, the perspective that you think is going to occur going forward when it comes to shelters, because we are encouraged to get our pets from shelters because obviously that's protecting and serving a greater purpose versus puppy mills and all these other kind of places. But on that front, when it comes to the no kill shelter perspective on things, which I think is, well, for me, it's certainly preferred. Is there advocacy work going on to try to ensure that that becomes consistent across the country?
So we could spend an entire podcast talking about this topic, but I am very passionate about this topic because the no-kill movement is a marketing tool. Mm. And essentially what no-kill means is something absolutely different to every person. There is no clearly defined outline of what no-kill means. Some organizations define it as we will never euthanize an animal. Some organizations define it as, well, we're no-kill because our save rate is above 90%. Some organizations define it as a way to manage their facility. And so when they are full and at capacity, then they don't admit any additional animals. So there's so many definitions, and, you know, as powerful as the no-kill movement has been, essentially the power has been in getting the average consumer and pet lover out there to differentiate between a shelter that they believe doesn't euthanize animals and a shelter that does. Right. Well, it gets more complicated than that. So you've got different ways that animals enter a shelter. You have animals that are stray, that are lost. That's a different way of entering than an animal that's being relinquished by their owner. Then you have animals that are confiscated as evidence in cruelty cases. Then you have animals that are brought in violation of code enforcement. So depending on the type of shelter, whether it's a municipal shelter that is under the health department or under the sheriff's department, you know, there's some animal shelters that are under the parks department. So depending on the infrastructure of your local government and what their obligation is in their city charter for their citizens to care for animal related issues, like running at large dogs, dangerous dogs. It's really complicated because depending on the type of service that animal shelter provides completely dictates how their policy on euthanasia. So an animal shelter that's a private shelter that's, you know, a nonprofit that does not have stray contracts, they don't take in stray animals, they certainly can treat their animal population very differently than a municipal shelter that is obligated by law to hold those animals for 3 to 4 days. So it's complicated, it's confusing. The average person doesn't understand the difference. And people don't think about animal shelters every day. They think about animal shelters when they need them. They think about them when they want to adopt, when they've lost their pet, when they want to get some type of service. But the average American doesn't wake up and think, wow, what's happening at the local animal shelter?
Right.
You know, so it's confusing to the public. And I think, what I feel has happened in the last 20 years is I feel like the no-kill movement came at a time where we really needed we really needed an opportunity to change the programming and some of the ways that we handle animals. And I think it was very powerful. But now, you know, it's 2021 and the animals coming into shelters and are so different than they were 25 years ago. 25 years ago, you could go into an animal shelter and find a purebred dog pretty easily. Nowadays, the population of shelter animals is very different. It's predominantly animals who have are staying on the adoption floor because they have some sort of medical or behavioral challenge. And so animals that, like Faith, for example, if your little Faith came into the shelter, she was adorable, she was cute, she was probably adopted within 24 hours. But the animals that are left on the adoption floor are difficult to place. They're difficult because maybe they're a pit bull or pit bull mix, and there's a lot of discrimination around that breed. You know, there are over, I don't know, there's so many obstacles to getting a pit bull as a dog because you've got homeowner insurance that gets canceled if you own that breed. You have housing policies that prohibit somebody from having a pit bull. For example, in Denver, just this last year, they had an ordinance that was over 20 years old banning pit bulls in the city of Denver. Well, that was not the best kind of policy, because did that mean that the pit bulls all went away? No, they didn't go away. They just had to be managed differently, and people had to circumvent that breed restriction. So I think, you know, for us, shelters have evolved into more of a resource for the community, which is what they really should be. So the animals that are coming in who aren't getting adopted quickly require medical attention or behavior modification in many instances. And so you need to have programs in place at your shelter to address those needs. And then the flip side of this is that there's been a lot of research done around, you know, what do pet consumers want? Well, they don't want a project animal. They want a cute, adorable baby that's part of their family. And so if you go into an animal shelter and it's, and you hear this across the United States, well, we went to our local animal shelter and all they have are pit bulls and pit mixes. And, you know, we can't find a dog at a shelter that we really want. And so what's interesting is the demand for pets is through the roof. And so like 2 years ago, I think the data was like there were 8 million puppies that were sourced in the United States. 8 million. Well, those puppies aren't coming from animal shelters. And even the animals entering shelters today cannot meet that demand because that people want puppies. Puppies aren't really coming into animal shelters anymore. And the animals that are at animal shelters are not what the consumer wants. And so there's a big controversy right now about what do animal shelters need to be doing when it comes to meeting the demand for puppies or for the pets of tomorrow. And so, you know, in some parts of the country, like New England, for example, for about the last 10 years, they've been having conversations on how do we establish humane breeding practices. And then you've got animal shelters in the southern areas just completely freaking out, like in Texas. And they're like, I can't believe you all are talking about breeding when our shelters are completely overcrowded and, you know, we've got a huge problem. You've got animals in certain parts of the country that are dying because of the volume of animals coming in. But what that does is that speaks to there is no governing body or federal regulatory system that oversees all shelters. They usually fall within the municipal government structure or they're a nonprofit. And so the inconsistencies between all the shelters across the nation are completely defined by their economic status. So if you have a well-run, fiscally responsible organization that has done strategic planning and infrastructure building, and they can fundraise and provide some of these behavior programs or the medical programs, then you're going to have a much healthier and more humane community for your pets. But you look at communities that are economically depressed, and animals are not at the priority of that community's financial means, you know, so when you look at, it's a socioeconomic issue. If your local animal shelter is surrounded by people of wealth, then they don't have a lot of problems. When you go into impoverished communities, they have a lot of problems. Sure. So it's hard to really understand the complexities, and you can't really compare the different shelters because you're really having to compare their socioeconomic status and what they can do for animals.
And I think, you know, what's really compelling, and thank you for that. That was awesome detail because, you know, like so many things, it does eventually end up in economics one way or the other. You know, here in LA, we have people stealing French pit bulls. French pit bulls? Whatever it's
French,
called.
French bulldogs.
French bulldog. Frenchies. Thank you. Yeah.
Bulldogs. Yeah. Yes. I have one.
All right. Well, there you go. And people are stealing them. I mean, we heard about the Lady Gaga thing and then, of course, other people as well. But I also reflect, Catherine, on what you said in terms of the shelters. You know, for me, it seems commonplace to, of course, educate myself so that I can find out, you know, answers to questions I have. So the question becomes, you know, summarily, if you're looking at a shelter, your question would be, do you not kill an animal under any circumstance? That's the only way to get at the core of what you're saying. And that's an educational type of approach that you have to take to it. But when you're looking at these parameters of the socioeconomic status, I think that we sometimes forget that the bureaucratization of things is a human attribute across all the social issues. We look at them from poverty, homelessness, it reminds me of what my mama used to say, which is, you know, she used to say, child, most things are simple. It's people who complicate the hell out of everything. And this seems to be the case here because while we on the one hand want to say, well, it's dogs and cats, but look what we've done based up on your very thorough description here to make all of this so complicated where we don't know what the hell is going on. And that kind of prompts me to, as we get ready to wrap up here, let's not dwell in that space where all of that crapola is happening, all of that bureaucracy. But as we look ahead, and you can begin with what is happening now and just kind of some anticipatory planning, the question I have is, what's the good news on the animal advocacy front that we can relate to and understand? And make sure that each of us, wherever we sit, if we care about animals, we can do something to help move that forward. What do you say?
I love this question because there's a lot for us to celebrate when it comes to pet ownership. And when you look at communities where, you know, pets are welcomed at restaurants and pets are welcomed in stores and pets are welcomed in the workplace, those particular spaces are so much more vibrant and really have cultures of engagement that you don't find, and it humanizes. And so when you really look and what can you do as an individual to help make this world a better place for animals and pets in general, I think it has a lot to do with your own core values and what you do as a pet owner. So it's something as simple as when you walk your dog, pick up after it. Don't give your neighbors a reason to be angry or frustrated because you're not picking up after your dog, because what happens is then that becomes an issue that has to be addressed. And so if you as an individual pet owner can sort of model the responsible behavior and lead by example, that is going to serve animals so well. If you are witness to any sort of animal abuse or neglect, you know, reporting that to the local organization that can help, you know, certainly helps, because as the lack of tolerance continues to grow for neglect, and a lot of people talk about cruelty, and but that isn't the real challenge. The real challenge mostly is in the space of neglect. And so, you know, I think we all have the power to lead by example and demonstrate why having a dog in a restaurant or at a store is okay. So don't take your dog into a store, let it run wild, let it, you know, defecate in the middle of the store. You know, I love it when I see people bringing their pets, you know, to hardware stores like Home Depot or Lowe's. And I love that because it normalizes having a pet. It normalizes that pets are a part of our society. And, you know, you can see people from different walks of life, different races, different socioeconomic statuses, and they, all of that melts away when they find each other in a store and there's a dog to introduce them. And they don't talk about anything else but that dog. And these are people who otherwise their path may never cross. And so I feel like animals bring us together and put us all on the same page. And I think, you know, like I said, animals help us become more compassionate, and that's really what we're all trying to be, right? We're trying to be a more compassionate society, more evolved.
Well, some of us are. I'm not going to say everybody is, but I appreciate the enthusiasm.
So, well, we all have to lead by example.
I agree with that. I fully
model the behavior that we want.
But you know, sometimes, Catherine, again, I quote my mom, you know, we have to call a thing. If a person's an asshole, they're an asshole, period. Just call it what it is. I do want to ask one more question before we wrap up here. And it occurred to me as you were describing that, you know, one of the things that I'm perplexed by is, I'm sure others may be, can you possibly go in and help the airlines deal with the service animal issue? Because I am, of course, a proponent, an advocate. I love animals. I've grown into it over the years. But I really am going to have an issue with the donkey butt in my face on the plane if that's a service animal. So can you go in and help them address that so that that's not a thing?
It's so funny that you bring that up, because there are so many people out there who sort of like to take advantage of the system. And so they'll say that they have an emotional support animal. Right. Well, that is not the same as a service dog.
Exactly.
You know, and so, you know, really that's something that the airline industry needs to regulate, and they really need to clearly define their policies around it. And it's hard, right? Because, you know, pet lovers and animal lovers, they they really want to be able to have that kind of experience with their pet. And I've seen some adorable animals on flights. And so that goes back to what we can all do as individuals. If you're going to take your pet on a flight, make it as positive of an experience for everyone else who's on that flight. You know, make sure that your pet is well cared for, secured properly, isn't running up and down the aisles. You know, do everything possible to be an ambassador for that type of program. Because when you're not, that's when, you know, those conversations have to start about, this isn't a good idea, this is a bad thing. You know, so I think as we normalize pets in the workplace, in stores, in flight, I think eventually we'll get to it, we'll find that balance. But it's like anything else. You have people who abuse the system, and you know, and you have people who take advantage, and it's unfortunate, but you know, because they just make it harder for those who are following the rules and trying to make it a positive experience for everybody. And it's hard too, because people do have pet allergies, and you have to be mindful of that and sensitive to it. So, you know, I flew with my dog once, and he, you know, was a very quiet little dog, but the woman next to me had an allergy. And so, you know, I felt bad for her, and they were able to move her on the plane. But, you know, you do have to think about that kind of thing. And it's really, again, having compassion, being thoughtful of other people, meeting people where they are, trying to do, you know, good in the world. And if we can't do it for ourselves, at least we can do it for our pets.
Well, and once again, it comes down to the humans. It's not the pets that are at fault here. It's the freaking humans that have to get this right.
Absolutely. And because I've always said, animals don't understand geographic boundaries. They don't understand, you know, socioeconomic issues. They just, those things don't matter to them. They matter to us.
Exactly. Hopefully we'll get it right. Catherine,
we will.
I have hope for it, because you're leading the charge along with others who are engaged in it. And I do know that animals, as I said before, they just elevate life's existence. This is a totally different Charles than there was 10, 20 years ago. And I'm so glad to have grown into this person. And I want to encourage you to keep doing what you've been doing for these more than 26 years now, and to continue to remind us that if we want to get all of that wonderful love and compassion that our, you know, animal friends provide us, that we need to extend it not only to them, but to each other. I think that's an important message.
Absolutely. What they can teach us is how to be kind and generous to others.
That sounds like a good way to end it. So thank you so much. And I look forward to keeping up with all of the work that you're going to continue to do.
Thank you, Charles. Thanks for making my world a lot brighter as well.
Oh, well, I'm impressed. See, look, I'm blushing. All right. Thank you.